You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I know some people are still shuffling in, but allow us to begin in the interest of time and having the most out of our conversation with Assistant Secretary Barton. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. I'm Noam Unger. I am a fellow with the Development Assistance and Governance Initiative here at Brookings, and I direct our Foreign Assistance Reform Project. It's a pleasure to welcome Assistant Secretary Barton, who was sworn in exactly 2 weeks ago, and I understand this is his first public discussion in his new role, and we are very happy to have him. His new role is as the head of the State Department's Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations. We have a great group gathered here today to hear about him, about his vision, his priorities, what are the priorities on his agenda. In picking Ambassador Barton for this role, President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton selected someone who has been deeply immersed in the thorny issues surrounding fragile states, human security, and the prevention, mitigation, and transformation of conflicts. For at least two decades, he has been a key figure at the center of related policy research, advancing U.S. and international understanding in this area, and he has also led key organizational efforts. Despite having been sworn in a couple weeks ago, Ambassador Barton has been in place gearing up for this new role for several months. He served for 2 years in his prior position as the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Economic and Social Council, ECOSOC. Before that, he directed the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has also served as the Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees at the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. And he was the founding director of the United States Agency for International Development's Office of Transition Initiatives, OTI. And I believe if you want further details, all of you should have his bio in front of you. It's illustrious, and it makes you realize that he really is a great person for this role. Today we're going to engage in a discussion. I'm sure we'll be talking about the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review, how it relates, what's new, and it's a real opportunity to hear from Ambassador Barton. It should be a wide-ranging discussion, and we should have ample time for questions from all of you. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Assistant Secretary Barton.
Well, thank you very much, Noam. One thing that I have to get used to is being called Assistant Secretary. I think that I heard that word more times with my name in the last 2 minutes than I have in my life. So it's very nice of you and to introduce me as generously as you did. And obviously to look out at so many old friends, I realize that there are people here who were working on this issue when I was back in Maine, sort of just trying to go through the New York Times each day. So I really appreciate the work that all of you have done and the commitment that so many of you have made to these issues. A number of my colleagues are here from CSO and from the State Department, and rather than recognizing everybody, I just really want to thank you for the wonderful work you've done in getting us to this point. I think having a bureau created at the State Department dedicated to this issue has been really on the minds of a number of you for some time, and it's really a great honor to have the chance to try to bring it to life. I think it's among our biggest challenges are really how to expand the community of people who recognize the centrality of these issues. Really, they've dominated our foreign policy for the last 20 years, and it's a fascinating area of challenge for us. But we have to expand the circle of people who think that our work is possible, that we can actually make a difference, because there's a healthy skepticism and a valid one on the part of the American public that we haven't been as successful in this space as we had thought we might be. And it's not been necessarily because of a lack of money or lack of effort. We've obviously seen rather significant efforts over the last decade. So there's a lot of room for improvement, and I hope that we can join in doing that together. What I'd like to do today is to give you fairly quickly, so we'll have the maximum amount of time for the conversation, is to give you a sense of what I think this Secretary of State, some of her predecessors, And certainly a number of people on the Hill and in the field have been are trying to do. What is our ambition as we look forward? And secondly, how are we going about it right now at CSO? And then finish up with just a kind of a brief summary of signs that we might be gaining traction so we can leave with a little bit of a sense of optimism. And the ambition, I think, is essentially to be more effective in an increasingly dynamic world. We have to be more effective. And as we look at the world, I think the first thing we have to think about is that we're really looking at a very different set of cases that we had. Those of us who got started in this in the 90s, we had literally dozens of boutique cases, small places with very, very serious problems. And we could see that what was likely to be happening as we looked ahead is that we were going to have big problems in medium-sized places and probably then even big problems in big, big places. But that was too awful to think about, so we weren't really preparing for that. And then in the last 10 years, we've had huge problems in rather large places, but not huge places, and we've made the maximum effort. But now we're entering a period where we really have popular uprisings. We have a range of global collapses that are not just economic and they're not just natural resource-based, but they'll come in a lot of different forms. And then we really have the emergence of these compound crises like we had in Haiti and in Japan, where everything seems to come together at the same time, and it has an incredibly disruptive global effect. But we also need to look, another thing we have to do if we're going to be more effective is we have to obviously have better preparation, anticipation, combined with genuine modesty. This is the toughest work on earth, and we have to recognize the need for help. So if you ever hear me say we're on top of this, we've got it under control, give me a quick call, send me an email, because we need all the help we can get. And that's true of the broader State Department as well, and the Secretary of State obviously recognizes that. A third thing we have to have to get this ambition thing right is recognize that the U.S. is going to be a pivotal and vital player, but not a dominant force. And so we've got to really think about the length of stay and the resources available right from the beginning rather than kind of this we'll get in there and then we'll make it up as we go along. A fourth thing we have to do is we have to have the growing impact of local ownership. Now, everybody talks about it, but I still don't believe that we do it. And it's got to be much, much earlier. It's got to be much more sincere. There are a lot of reasons for it. One, we just can't, there are a lot of places we can't go to any longer. We don't travel as freely as we used to. But we've got to make this much more genuine. And then we obviously have to expand our partners. We've got to be much more agile in who we play with and who we count on to do other things. And I think one warning if our ambitions are going to be achieved, and that is that we've got to beware of the standard arguments. I too often hear that we need more time, we need more money, there's an absorptive capacity problem. We know we have risk-averse bureaucracies. We overstate our influence. I mean, there are a lot of things that we're guilty of that undermine our likely effectiveness. But I think we have a shot at it. And so the second area I'd like to cover is what are we doing? What's happening right now at CSO? Again, I hope this will just serve to provoke some of our conversation. What we're trying to do is we're trying to fashion an organization that can be influential in policy and in programming and have the maximum impact in the first 12 months of a crisis. This is our proof of concept year. When I went up to the Hill, and my first, unusual for the State Department, before I even had my hearing, I was sent up to the Hill to sell the Bureau and to the four key committees of the Congress. And every one of them expressed let's call it a healthy skepticism about where we currently stood. And so I had to use my argument was that we would prove this concept over the next year. When I was back a few weeks ago to talk about the budget with the Senate appropriators, I did try to make it clear that the year did not start until I was confirmed, trying to link these two benefits, but I'm not sure we achieved the renegotiation of the timeline yet. But essentially, we told the Secretary of State that that we would try to do three things in this coming year. And the first thing is that we feel that this new bureau has to prove its worth. It has to make a valued contribution in 2 to 3 places of real significance to the United States. We will dedicate 80% of our effort to sort of the major cases, and I'll describe some of those in a minute. And then we'll have probably another 8 or 10 places that we'll be working in, and I'd love to, in the question and answer, talk to you about some of the one-offs that you can do in places that can make a huge difference by just sending the right person to the right place at the right time. It doesn't take all of the might of the U.S. government to actually make a difference. The second thing we told the Secretary of State is that we needed to build a trusted and respected team. And so we're going about that. And the third is we said we needed to work in a more innovative and agile way. So to get there, we've been rather busy over the last few months in making a lot of changes. And I'd just like to give you a quick summary of some of those. We've hired an all-new leadership team of 4 senior people. We have new directors at every level, several from the old SCRS, and we're trying to get a blend of the old SCRS and also bring in some fresh blood so that we get a balance. We crosswalked 150 employees. We are restructuring the Civilian Response Corps right now, which is a very difficult conversation with many of our partners in the federal government. We're increasing the money for deployments at a time of decreasing budgets. We closed our Springfield warehouse and office. We're on a glide path in Afghanistan and South Sudan. We're refocusing on key places. And we're rethinking about 40% of our budget. I sort of like to think that a radical change in the State Department is around 8%. So I don't know what 40% is, but it feels like warp speed at sometimes. So what we're really going through is it's a startup. It's a merger let's describe it as a change-resistant environment during tight fiscal times. So it sounds like a good case study for somebody who wants to write up a business school tract here. And we're also trying to look at the way we are going about our work. So we're insisting in every case on a center of gravity within the U.S. government and within the State Department. There's got to be somebody that is kind of in charge of the case. Otherwise, it gets really hard to do the work. And that we're doing that both at the State Department and within CSO. And we're trying to use what you might call a board of directors model. Let's engage at the front end as many people as have an interest in the case so we don't end up with people taking a shot at what's going on later. As you all know, in almost every case within the department, there will be at least these many levels of interest or engagement. And if somebody holds their breath here or here or here, the whole thing doesn't work. And so what we've tried to do, what we're starting to do within CSO is identify the 12 obstacles that we run into in every case, which the 12, many of them are bureaucratic obstacles, so that we know what that journey is. And then that doesn't serve as an excuse for us not being able to do something, that this problem arose or that problem arose. We knew it beforehand, plan on it, anticipate it, and deal with it. But then most critically, once you have that in place, when I was at CSIS, I had a talk that so depressed audiences that I had to change the title. The first couple of times I gave it, it was the 3 chronic problems of every U.S. engagement in one of these cases. And the audiences came up to me at the end and said, did you have to do that? I already was depressed enough without your telling me what the 3 chronic problems are. So I quickly refashioned the speech to be the 5 critical elements of success. at which point, I had American audiences who were willing to go through the struggle of what we were doing. And among these were that everybody goes out there and does their own analysis. That's the first problem. So you have to have joint, locally driven analysis. And we're really trying to push that. And it's not going to be dominated by CSO. It's any combination of people. We just did this in Burma. AID had, I think, three people out of the seven on the team. I think CSO had one. We ran it through Derek Mitchell, the special envoy. We're just trying to make sure that those local voices are heard and they drive the thinking that takes shape after that. That should then lead to an integrated strategy that has two or three top priority items. We know in these places they need everything, but I'm skeptical of the state building, nation building model. I believe that what we have to do is give people the opportunity to make it on their own. We have to be catalytic. That's quite ambitious in and of itself. It's not to give up on the broader ambition, but it's to let the people have the ownership of it themselves. But it starts with us having a focused strategy. And then the third point is to make sure that the resource flows go to the strategies. Now, a place like Burma is an interesting case. It's exotic, it's safe, and it's promising. So almost everybody's going to want to work there. And for us to be coherent is one of our centerpieces of our being effective. So these are all ways of being more coherent. And finally, making sure that there's constant timely review rather than having evaluations 2 years after the fact, that we have real-time McKinsey-like reports that say these are things you should be changing today because they're not going right. And that's something else that we haven't seen. So finally, let me just finish up on, are we gaining traction? Well, I think in the four major cases that we're starting to work on, we're starting to see the kind of organizational structure that we're going to have if we're going to be effective, if the U.S. is going to have influence. And the ones that we're working on right now are Kenya, at the top of our pile, are Kenya, Burma, Syria, and North Central America. Very different cases, very different in stages of development, but each of them have a tremendous potential for opportunity and for heading the wrong direction. And I'd be happy to describe more in our conversation what we're trying to do there. I do think what we're trying to do is creative. We're getting great support from the Secretary of State, the National Security staff, and our colleagues. And I'm finding that we're getting a growing recognition among ambassadors and the regional bureaus. Many of you who work these accounts recognize that those are critical partners. We're going to have an office in the State Department for the first time, perhaps ever, and we'll have all of our employees within sight of each other by the fall. That may not sound that important, but it does really make a difference in terms of how cohesive our own team is. We're bringing partners into the game much earlier and trying to show that this is not just the State Department's game, but this is a shared responsibility. And we're working aggressively at changing the culture of what was SCRS into CSO. SCRS worked hard to gain a space, and now we're trying to increase our impact. And the way some of the things we're trying to do in that space are we're trying to move to we prefer the sins of commission versus sins of omission. So take a risk, come up with ideas, and if you don't have ideas, come back when you do. We're trying to be much more rigorous in our analysis and show evaluative thinking. Don't just go out to places, but actually tell us what you've learned. We've had more people outside of the capital in South Sudan than any other part of the U.S. government for the last couple of years. So bring it together. What have we learned? What should the policy of the U.S. government be to reflect what we've learned out there and take ownership of that space? Because that's what's expected of us. I mean, that's what a bureau is about. Stick to the truly important. Don't get sidetracked. Be the anti-bureaucracy. Don't make the argument for what CSO should be doing, but let's make the argument for what needs to happen. And I can almost guarantee that there will be a space for CSO within what needs to happen, that either because other people don't want to do it or because they can't get to it for the next year or a variety of reasons. And be the easiest bureau at the State Department to work with. That may not sound like that high bar, but that's part of it. So I think all these things are taking hold. Our leadership team has been in place now for about a month, a little more than a month. And when the Secretary of State called me the other day, And we, at the end of the conversation, she asked, how are things going? And I said, well, I think they're going pretty well. I've been using this cruise metaphor. And I said, the first 4 months, we just spent getting everybody on board, because there's quite a lot of to do there. And now we're in the ocean trial, sea trial, shakedown cruise period, and we hope we too many people won't drop off. But in a couple of months, we expect to be in a Caribbean port with pearl divers. And she laughed and she said, "Well, that's when I'd like to join up with you." So I think we have it in our sights. We know where we'd like to end up. There's an awful lot to be done. The world is going to keep producing crises for us. We have no doubt about that. And the internal bureaucratic challenges are substantial to really making an effective organization. So I hope that gives you a little bit of a taste. I'm sorry if I've gone on longer than a conversation would suggest, but I'm hoping that it'll also set up some questions from Noam and from all of you. And again, thank you all for everything that you've done in this space to really give us this opportunity. We're going to take it as far as we can and really appreciate your help. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. And while we get set up, if you are sitting next to a seat that is open, please raise your hand because we've got some people in the back. If anyone wants to grab a seat, please grab one of those open seats. We don't need to have anyone stand through the whole discussion. Rick, thank you very much for that introduction to what it is you're doing. Clearly, you know, you approach this with this, I'd say, maybe seasoned and reasoned approach. I have lots of questions, and let me just sort of work through them, and we'll
should
have.
Should I take four from you?
Yeah. Well, why don't we have a little bit of a conversation, and then I want to open it up to the audience. So, it sounds to me like underlying what you said, there's a bit of an assumption, and I think it's one that many people share. But I just want to have it be clear. What has happened in this space over the last 10 years has been, at least in the most prominent fashion, major stabilization operations on the part of the U.S., you know, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, the big money, big ticket items. And it sounds like the assumption is that this bureau should not or will not be in the game of preparing and planning for similar engagements down the road, and that the focus is on short-term or transitional help in smaller cases. As you said, big problems in big places, you know, big problems in smaller places. Can you flesh that out a little bit more in terms of the underlying assumptions?
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's not. I'm hoping that we will not have, as a citizen, we will not have too many more of the Iraqs and Afghanistan types of engagements, because I think they were just really questionable in many, 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 many ways. But that would be as a citizen. I do think there's a chance for more complicated cases, though. And so we're probably the three kinds of cases that we're looking at right now are hot spots that exist. So the ones that I mentioned are more in the hot spot category right now. But then I think there are sort of big places that we have not really we're not really thinking ahead well enough on, and that we will probably get into more. So there are going to be major transitions in places like North Korea, or you know, you can name several others over the coming years. And it would be good to know that our civilian perspective and our civilian planning is superior to our military planning, which I don't think is the case right now. It's not even comparable. So those could be big and complicated cases. But again, they will not be cases where the United States will own the case. I mean, obviously, the region, the people, the countries in the region will be the most influential, I would guess. And then the third kinds of cases that we are not touching as much yet, but I think will show up in our menu as we go along, as we get more established, are kind of these long-standing, but almost forgotten cases. You could put Kashmir, you could put the Kurds in the Kurdish case, and others that are out there. They're not really getting that much. Some of them may be getting better with age. We hope they are, but that's not necessarily the case. So I think that our menu will get broader and get richer as time goes on. But we're new, and we really need to prove ourselves to our colleagues and to ourselves. And then we will have the opportunity, we will be called upon to do more and more. And we find even now within the geographic bureaus, for example, at the State Department that are most familiar with SCRS, like the African Bureau in particular, but also Bob Blake's Bureau, that they're more likely to call upon us. And we're now getting better known by the Near East and by WHA because we're working with them. And so that people have, so a lot of it is just gaining the credibility. In terms of the big places, I think there's an implied criticism of the big cases. And when I was doing some of the work with my colleagues here from CSIS, some of the CSIS colleagues who are here today, I was particularly struck when I went out to Afghanistan that almost everybody I spoke to in Afghanistan described to me this how successful their individual program was. So I kind of wondered how 100 individual successes added up to one very questionable larger effort. It didn't seem to be any mathematical equation that I was familiar with. Plus, 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 plus equals negative. And so it got me to thinking that, you know, everybody, and of course almost everybody had a reason. If only the Germans would do this, if the United States wouldn't do that, if that NGO was up to this, if that minister was, and so there was always a good argument for why it wasn't taking hold. But it also just completely reinforced this kind of sprawling approach that we take to these places where we kind of take on ownership and then we want all these things to happen. And it also, in my conversation with the Secretary of State when she interviewed me for this job, we talked a bit about how when she goes to places, she ends up with almost inevitably the same list of deliverables, irrespective of the case. And it was sort of, why do I always end up talking about counterterrorism, counter-drugs, AIDS, humanitarian refugees, food, because these are the things the U.S. has existing big-time pipelines. But it doesn't necessarily speak to what's needed in the place. And so the first question we always want to answer that we're trying to instill as part of our culture is, okay, what is most needed as opposed to what can the United States do? Well, the United States can do everything to some extent. But when it does that, it lacks impact. It doesn't convert the case. And I mean, I believe that there's a tipping point in these cases, and I believe that if you drive hard enough to it, the people of the place have a shot.
Are you defining crises in your opening discussion? You mentioned Haiti and Japan in the same sentence.
Yeah.
Are you defining crises in a specific fashion or leaving it flexible?
I think in our case, the crises are mostly conflict centered right now. I mean, that's where we are taking our attention.
Okay. And let me ask you this, because in my own experience, I worked in the last startup phase of the predecessor organization.
And so you're the guy who did this.
You're sworn in as the coordinator for reconstruction and stabilization in addition to your assistant secretary title,
I believe.
It's
the longest title in history.
One of the criticisms of SCRS was that relatively quickly the coordination function of the entity fell apart or fell off the map. And this was a challenge for, you know, the predecessor that was created by PDD 56 in the Clinton administration. What you're talking about achieving requires both intensive coordination across the U.S. government and also coordination internationally with partners. you know, what are you in your vision with CSO doing differently to tackle those problems?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we have a great awareness of the challenge. But I was lucky enough to have a boss once, Doug Stafford, that many of you are lucky to have known, who said, never, ever, 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 ever accept the job of a coordinator. And because he probably had a few more evers in there, I've never seized upon that word. So the word that we've used is that we will drive this process. Okay, so we see it's not that we necessarily need to be the coordinator, but we will drive to make sure there's a center of gravity. We will drive to make sure that the analysis is joint and it's locally driven. We will drive to make sure that there's actually an integrated strategy with two or three priorities. And so in every case, so we have an ambition in every space, and we will make sure that somebody in every meeting is focused in that way. And my guess is that over time, we will also be asked sometimes to be the center of gravity, to be in the lead. But for the moment, we're quite happy making sure that when we see a capable person who seems to have the right combination of skills and personality, that we are embracing that individual with as much passion as we can bring to it, because we believe that that's the way that things have a chance of getting done within our bureaucratic structure. So
I think that that'll raise probably a lot of questions for our audience, and we'll get to them after one last question from me.
You mean that answer did not answer the question?
Well, to be fair, as a conversation, I actually think that that previous efforts didn't lack success for a lack of ambition and goodwill.
Correct.
And
sure,
interest in driving things. People would look at more hard topics like, do they have any resources to provide? You know, what authorities do they have? What's the role of the White House? And all of the, you know.
We're doing that as well. I mean, I have to say we're spending a lot of time on, somebody said that 50% of the diplomatic mission in this job would be within the State Department. I don't know if that is proving to be correct or not, but it takes a fair amount of time and effort, and we're dedicating that effort, but we're also trying to create some liquidity and to have a little bit of programming money. Johanna will remember that when we were starting OTI, we had a modest amount of money. I think it was $20 million, and the first year was 10, but it was only about three quarters of a year, But I used to say to the people who worked at OTI, go into every meeting as if you had $20 million in your pocket. Now, fortunately, I'd worked for some real estate developers in Maine, so I was really familiar with this. a guy who only had a triple decker, and he suddenly was talking about a 10-story office tower downtown. It was, you wondered sort of how he made that leap. But we're going to do the same thing. We're telling our people now that go into every meeting as if you had $10 million. Okay? Now you're not guaranteed $10 million, because you got to come up with the ideas that are going to convince us that you can make a difference. But I do think that it gains us some access. So I don't want to just expeditionary diplomacy has been is I stayed away from that for so long, but now I'm starting to find maybe a way that it's coming into clarity in my own mind. It is not sending somebody who's very much like all the other diplomats to a place they otherwise wouldn't go to do what all the other diplomats are doing. So it is not sending somebody to a new part of South Sudan to have that person report. That doesn't seem to me to be expeditionary diplomacy. That person's going to go out there. They really better be capable of doing the reporting, but they better be able to also start addressing some of the kind of low-hanging fruit that exists in all these places in terms of bringing people together, mediating problems, whatever it happens to be. One way that you can do that is to have a little liquidity. So I would like to have anybody who's out there on an engagement for our bureau thinking that they have a $1 million credit line back at the home office.
Walking around money.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. but it's going to have to be much more strategic than that. But I want them to at least have that mindset.
Right. Right.
And so that's an affirmative mindset that you actually have the opportunity to solve problems.
So you come at this job with experience from UNHCR, with experience at the UN and ECOSOC, and the UN, and you were talking about expanding partners internationally and also about effectiveness at the High Level Forum on aid effectiveness in Busan. The U.S. supported an international New Deal, you know, in an approach to fragile states. What's new about it? And how does it affect sort of the thinking within State Department?
Well, I'm not sure the intellectual content is that new, because a lot of us who've worked in this space have gone through the pillars that they pretty much. But what's really new about it is one of the points that I tried to make in the opening of my remarks, which is that local ownership piece, that assertion by these countries that we want to be in charge. And by the way, we want them to be in charge. I mean, is there anybody here who wants to own any of these cases?
Except that's the problem is in the situation when the question is who's the they, if you're talking about the state side, on the government side.
Well, I mean, and that's, I think, another mistake that we've made, is that we've too often looked for our partners to be the governments. And I think we always have to balance that. And the balance has to be in favor of the people of the place. And, I mean, and you can find the people of the place without sticking a finger in the eye of the government, but sometimes you have to stick a finger in the eye of the government. I mean, there is an element of this work that is subversive of the status quo. You know, we used to, there was a great guy that I quote often, Bob Gersony, but he used to talk about the status quo ante. Well, the status quo ante in a lot of places is terrible. And we would have no interest in the place if we were going to go back to what it was. So, because that would be kind of a reaffirmation of ruling elites or whatever they happen to be. So, for example, the work we're looking at in Syria right now that we're trying to advance is to help make the opposition within Syria more capable.
Well,
lots of fodder
for questions. I'll withhold any more of my own. I'll turn right here to the front. I'll take these two questions together.
And here comes a microphone.
And there's a microphone coming. And please identify yourself and really make it a question. That'll further the conversation. These two right next to each other in the front. We'll group them.
John Harbison, Johns Hopkins SAIS. Good to see you again. Kenya, given Kofi Annan's 4-year project in Kenya, what is your priority?
Let's take the second question together. Okay. So, Kenya.
Second academic, Patricia Fagan, Georgetown University. Thanks for this talk. It's really refreshing. I have a concern. I have many, but there's one I want to raise.
Give me all of your concerns.
No, I can't do that. because it's a very positive approach. Let's suppose it's success, that within there's a 12-month plan, it's comprehensive, it succeeds, there are partners on the ground, there's a sense of accomplishment. What happens in month 13? If in month 13 everybody goes away, then a lot of the accomplishments will surely be lost, because local partnerships need accompaniment of some kind.
Yeah.
There has to be some kind of support strategy after the big blitz of U.S. will do it and now it's your turn ends. So I'd like you to comment on that, please.
Thank you. So good. Kenya and sustained support.
Let me take the second question first. When you started the question, Pat, I thought you were asking about sort of this proof of concept year and the 12 months of CSO. And I was thinking, in the 13th month, we will rest. but that would work also in the case of the country itself. You know, my feeling about this is that these places, I mean, what you're really trying to do is to get things going. And so And you start off in a fairly broad space, but what you're trying to do is to get everybody to concentrate effort. But the initial provocations, the initial things that we do should fit well within this broader highway that we're going, that we're heading on. So it shouldn't be anything that's just kind of, these are not one-offs that just take place by themselves, but they should fit within the broader strategy. We're trying to develop right now a kind of a strategic template for CSO that is essentially driven by the context, by what we think is going to happen, and then by what stated U.S. policy is. So we fit. That's where we fit. And then what most needs to happen, and this all onto one page, so everybody can understand what it is. I've mentioned this to quite a few people in the State Department. They said, gee, when you get this, will you share it with us? I mean, it's a pretty simple way to make sure that we're all on the same sheet of music. So if we're all on the same sheet of music, then whether we're there 9 months, 90 days, or 3 years, it doesn't become as important because there are other players. But let me just, in talking, for example, to Bill Brownfield in INL, he said, look, it really takes us about a year to get going in a place. If you talk to OTI, it takes them a couple of months, so they're faster. If you talk to sort of regular development people at AID or state or World Bank, we're talking probably a longer period of time. So, but we'd like to get everybody on this pretty much the same highway, so we don't have 1,000 points of light. So that's really our critical contribution. If we can then show that there are things that can be done. For example, we're talking about North Central America now because a lot of people, including the Secretary of State, are very concerned about the growing violence in the northern triangle of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And there are a lot of people doing many, many good things. Some of the AID missions down there are celebrating their 50th anniversary. So there are people that I've run into who have been doing rule of law training in that part of the world for, well, going back a few decades. So how do you create a sense of urgency when the answer is, in 2 years, we're going to have these three critical vetted police units, and we'll have these 12 honest judges, and we'll have this new court system, and I mean, things that Mark would be highly familiar with. So what we brought to the conversation is, those are all wonderful things. What can we show in the next 30, 60, 90 days that might be evidence that some of them are taking root? Because the national narrative in a place like Honduras, I've been told, I haven't seen this in writing, but one of my colleagues told me, that 60% of Hondurans think they're going to be a victim of a violent crime in the coming year. Now, only 4% are likely to be victims, but what's the narrative? 60% think that they're going to be victims. So what can you do? Well, how many arrests? You've got this wonderful program. How many people are going to be arrested? How many people are going to be deported? How many people are going to be tried? How many people are going to be convicted? All of those things have measurable elements. What are you missing in that vetted police unit? Oh, you're missing a prosecutor. Well, so in other words, they can actually arrest somebody, but what happens to the person? So it turns out that they're holes. So there are places that you can make a difference, but it's not off the program. It's not creating a new program. It's not saying, oh, you got to come in and do something totally different. I suspect there are opportunities for that too. But that's one way we're trying to get at. It's sort of keeping it in a practical zone. So I hope that answers that question. On Kenya, you obviously, John, know more than I do about this. So I'm going to make my answer really brief. I think there are some people who worry that there's still a very real opportunity for violence of the kind that was seen in the last election. And while the conventional wisdom right now says a lot of things are in train, some of us worry that it's not necessarily going to come together in the way that we would like it to. So that there's an opportunity here and to maybe either help accelerate some things, draw more attention to some things that are taking place, or to just, again, just sound a little bit more of an alarm in this space, if needed. And we don't know that yet. Our team is going, we have a team going out that's going to be, again, a joint team that's going out at the end of this week for, I think, about 6 weeks of, in particular, looking at some of the places where there some of the geographic locations and some of the communities and some of the populations like youth that we think may need more attention.
In the back, I see a gentleman with his hand up right on the aisle there.
Thank you. I'm Leon Weintraub, University of Wisconsin, Washington Semester International Affairs. I'd like to ask you, sir, if you saw a role for your bureau in two different situations of West Africa. One is in Mali, where we already have the specter of a separatist state and some degree of violence. And the other would be in Nigeria, where on the one hand it's a very strong ally, but there's been an undercurrent of violence, of some separatism for a number of decades, and the government just doesn't seem to have a handle on it. What, if any, do you see a role of your bureau?
And also, why don't we take the question just across the aisle? I think it's Greg Hermsmeyer there. Yep.
Hi, Rick. Congratulations on your role.
Thank you.
Greg Hermsmeyer, now Deloitte Consulting. I wanted to follow up on the liquidity question. Since the transition, the Hill has cut some of the legacy SCRS funding and programs, Section 1207, Security and Stabilization Assistance Authority that allowed DOD to transfer funding to state expired almost 2 years ago. How will CSO program officers and policymakers tap into that liquidity? And a related question, what role will CSO play in the new joint State Department and DOD Global Security Contingency Fund and the USAID Complex Crisis Fund?
The pooled funds, is that what?
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Let me take those two. Yeah. Again, let me just start with a second question, if I could. The Congress and this administration, prior administration, have created new funds, and I believe that we're going to be one of the F Bureau's critical partners in helping to direct those funds to the best cases. One of the things that I think is fair about the 1207 funding was that it became a little bit of an embassy plus up fund as opposed to a crisis fund. And that it turned out that irritated some of the people on the Hill. And so we took a strong look at the 1207 fund right away when I got there. Now, it turns out it was about $450 million. We identified right away $105 million that had not even been obligated. So when you talk about a crisis and the money had been directed to an embassy 2-3 years ago, it doesn't have the ring of a crisis when it hasn't been obligated in that period of time. So we sent out a very direct cable just before Christmas that alerted all the embassies to the fact that we had an interest in this $105 million. We had some incredibly productive days that followed, and much of that money found ways to be obligated to good use. But there's still, I'd say, $30 to $40 million that's probably right now that we're looking at. And we've already deobligated $15 million, and we will probably deobligate the other, but there are some delicate matters that we need to work out with embassies. We also identified about another $110 million that had been obligated and had not been spent. So that's another area of opportunity, but we felt that there were some missing pieces here. Where's the strategy? Why does it take so long for this money to get the decision to be made? And how come there are no evaluations? So, or the evaluations are not field driven. So we're doing all those things. Again, we're not doing them across the board. We're just doing them random sample, see what we learn, and see if we can change. We did this together with our DOD colleagues. We had a very productive first luncheon, which we hosted. And we all agreed that we could be more strategic, we needed to be faster, and we needed to do evaluations. And so all that's taking place. So it's DOD, AID, the F Bureau, and CSO. That's the core board of directors. And I believe that it will probably that these experiences are going to be helpful to these other funds as well. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that the money that's deobligated is redirected to some of the top priority cases that we're describing. Of the $450 million, I mean, it'd be interesting for those of you who haven't studied it. About $100 million went to Georgia, which suggested that there was a strategic focus. And then the rest sort of went all over the place.
And Mali and
yeah,
Nigeria.
Yeah, Mali and Nigeria. Northern Nigeria in particular is of real interest to us. We're just starting to do the due diligence on that. And we're several weeks into kind of reviewing it, looking for opportunities, what needs to happen, what we might do. So it hasn't turned into an engagement yet, but it's a place that we're and Mali we have not. You know, one of the problems is that we're trying to, and it could well be the case that we should be involved in, but we're trying to decide what places does the United States have a really critical function, a lead function, and Mali doesn't. We don't see that being a case where that happens. You know, I've been dying to tell you this Liberia story, so maybe I can
tell the Liberia story. And then what we'll do is we'll take two more questions and then just a really quick response.
Yes or no?
Okay. I'll
say the Liberia story anyway.
But we would like to hear it if you're dying to tell it.
Well, I mean, it sort of shows what you can do in a small place with just the right thing at the right time. And we had a call from the U.S. ambassador at the time, Linda Thomas Greenfield. The day before the election in Liberia, there was a demonstration by the opposition a few blocks from the president's house on one of the few main roads out of town. And at some point in the demonstration, they tried to break it up because it was blocking traffic. And one person was killed and eight people were injured, gunfire. And there were eyewitnesses that said they thought the police that we had been quite involved with in training and preparing had been involved in the shooting. The president was told that it sort of got the kind of report that sometimes you get when you're the boss. And she relayed that to the ambassador when she called the president. And the ambassador was really quite concerned that all of the goodwill that had built up over the last seven years, would be put at risk. The president appointed a commission of inquiry, and it was a particularly good group of citizens, but they were given a two-week mandate, and none of them had ever conducted an investigation before. So when they finished their work, they didn't come up with much, and it was ridiculed for being insufficient. So it was one of these key confidence-building moments in a political system that you sort of get it right or you don't. And Linda called us and asked if we could get her somebody who could help this commission because the president was going to extend its charge, but they clearly needed to professionalize their investigation. We had a guy named Stephen Anderson who was on our civilian response corps who's a Justice Department employee, and he went over there and he right away hired a Liberian investigator, and the commission then decided that he needed a second one to make sure there was a balance. And these people immediately went out and interviewed 70, 80 people, and they got a pretty good eyewitness sense of what happened. They also discovered that it was a ton of video and still photography of the event because it was a big public demonstration the day before the election. So everybody was there. In the course of the investigation, one of these Liberian investigators spotted in a 15-second frame of the video that there was a man in a very distinct shirt and a heavy armband that couldn't recognize his face shooting the gun. You could hear pop, smoke, and the gun was pointed at a crowd. So then they had a ton of still photography and they identified the shirt and so they identified who it was. And it happened to be a prominent police official. They took that 15-second film, and he showed it to our lawyer, Stephen Anderson, who looked at it, and in the same 15 seconds, he saw a policeman in a gas mask firing a gun as well that the investigator hadn't seen. And they then took the same 15 seconds and showed it to the commission, and one of the commission members saw a third person, a policeman in a gas mask. And again, so the case was solved, basically. And they came back, and the commission has now written a report, which the president has accepted. They have permanently suspended four members of the police force, and they have temporarily suspended another group of officers. And they're now looking at it as one of these great justice cases, rule of law cases. Will they prosecute it? Well, I mean, they have to decide all these things. These issues are still to be played.
So this is an example of when you were saying, you know, we're going to be 80% in our priority countries, but in 8 to 10 countries, it's about sending the right person at the right time.
Yeah, and you just might get lucky. I mean, you might get lucky this way. This is obviously sensationally fortunate. The president accepted the report and took responsibility for it. The report has not been released yet. But it's obviously the suspension and all those things are public information. So it's just a phenomenal opportunity in a lot of these cases to help an ambassador, to help a country at a critical moment. And in other cases, we might get in, and what looks like a small case might end up being one of our signature cases. Because, I mean, you know, you'd have to be crazy to think that you know how every one of these cases is going to unfold. I mean, we could be sitting watching Syria for minutes or for months, and that's why we're trying to focus on things you can do with the opposition from out, the internal opposition from outside the country.
If the audience will indulge me, allow me to take two more questions, and we'll do it really quick.
Sure. I'll try for faster answers too.
We'll start right up here up front, and remember, please identify
woman back
yourself.
Here who looks like she's been waving madly.
And yes, you're talking about the woman who's
yes, that one
far from the aisle and difficult to get the microphone to. She'll be our last question there.
Great.
Please go ahead.
Mark Schneider, International Crisis Group. As you know, Rick, many of us who have worked with you are quite pleased to see you in this position.
Thank you.
We also feel sorry for you to some degree. But one of the thoughts that I had is that to some degree, you're describing a diplomatic SWAT team approach, where these four cases are very different in terms of the countries involved.
Yeah.
Kenya, Burma, Syria, the Northern Triangle, Central America. And I'd be interested in whether you see them. Obviously, they're important to the United States for a whole variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether you see them in the context of what we're doing, the specific things that we're doing are aimed at preventing the next conflict. That is, that while they're aimed in some degree in Burma, transition, et cetera, that there's something behind it in terms of avoiding conflict down the road.
Sure.
And that relates to, do you see yourself engaged more with the new, whenever it happens and it's announced, the Atrocity Prevention Board that's...
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Presumably going to come into existence soon.
Yeah.
And finally, the two things that strike me as very similar to two of these cases, Kenya and Syria, you mentioned, Kofi Annan is a special representative.
Yeah.
So on your board of directors, mm-hmm. How are you going to get the right international people at the table in order to bounce your plans on what you want to try and do off them and get the benefit of their experience and wisdom?
Yeah,
that was. And let's last question. Then
should I answer Mark's six questions first? Or?
If you'd like, then we'll still take that one more question. That's
okay.
Fine.
Either way, I mean, I think there are enough questions on the table that it'd probably be good to hit a few of them.
Sure.
Yes, there is a strong prevention bias here, because I mean we know that in every crisis or conflict case, it has the opportunity to recidivism is probably the default position. So, yes, I mean, there is a real prejudice in that area. You didn't say good luck, but the two things I heard the first few months that I was, after I was named to this job, I heard the same two words, but said very differently. I heard half the people said, good luck. And the other half of the people said, good luck. And that seemed to be the common message. So the way you said it had some of that. I mean, I like the thought of a diplomatic SWAT team. I mean, one of the things that Doug Stafford used to call OTI was the Peace Corps on steroids. And I mean, there are all kinds of descriptions. I think if it speaks to urgency, if it speaks to using diplomatic skills, I'd like to use a lot of the stuff that you guys, that ICG, for example, is famous for. I'd like to have that that really tough analytical view that we're almost overly dependent on you guys to deliver. I mean, how about the honest, frank assessment of what's going on? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with a good creative tension? I mean, I'm a big fan of brainstorming, but there was this great story in the New Yorker that said it tried to take on the idea of brainstorming, but I don't think it really did. It basically said brainstorming only works when there's creative tension. Okay, fine. I mean, brainstorming isn't for everybody. Everybody's idea to be equally wonderful. I mean, there's a winnowing process that takes. Well, there's not enough of that in the government space, and I hope we can do that again in a way that's so respectful of our colleagues that they don't just think we're taking shots at them, which that won't get us. We won't go anywhere if we do that. So it's a pretty fine line that we have to tread, but I think we can do it. And yes, of course, the Atrocity Prevention Board is going to be a presidential initiative. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, why wouldn't we want to be thinking that way? And that's definitely motivating us in the work we're looking at in Syria, in Kenya, in particular. I don't think that it's the quality of the other two places yet, but hopefully it won't be, that every crisis won't have an atrocity at the end of the line. And the right international people, you know, we're working hard at figuring out who our 10 key partners are and trying to, again, look, there are going to be 100, but we have to make sure we do right by those who are most critical to us. I do think the multilateral space, you know, I have a strong belief in it. I do think we're probably going to do our best work in the countries, with working with the embassy and working with whoever else is there in that particular country. I would guess that would be our first test, but we'll see. I mean, we're trying to do it theoretically as well. But I would like to have us have shared platforms. I mean, we're already in South Sudan. Our people are essentially residing at with the WFP, the World Food Program, on their secure, more or less secure bases. So that's a good model. I mean, why should we all rent the last remaining house in some town? And so, I mean, those are the kinds of things that just have aggravated almost all of us who have ever spent time in the countries. Wondering, why did we hire the only 6 teachers to be our drivers? And why did we take over the 5 houses that were habitable? It was just, so I hope we'll get richer in our understanding.
So if you have a brief question.
Sure.
I'm sure that Ambassador Barton will try to answer it in you know, his best 2 sentences to answer your question.
I'm very good at true or false and multiple choice.
And please identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Mary Stata with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. And my question is regarding actually some advice from you in terms of criticism that I often hear from appropriators and authorizers on the Hill when looking at the various conflict prevention capacities within state and USAID, particularly with CMM, with OTI, with former SCRS, and now with CSO, is how to avoid duplication of efforts, but at the same time maximize coordination. So yeah. I'm curious as to how you intend to broach these issues with these various capacities,
sure.
And also how I, as an advocate, can message that to the Hill.
Well, I think the point of a bureau is to make sure that we're getting coherent policy, okay, so that we're bringing people together in the most productive possible way. My belief is that OTI is going to, for example, is going to be much more of a programming organization than we are. But what they've been missing is a place at the table early in the conversation. So they've been extremely entrepreneurial in finding space and opportunities to do some really creative programming. But they haven't necessarily been part of the broader process early enough on. And so I see
them
as
the policy process?
The policy process, yeah. And that's a chronic complaint at AID, that the State Department shows up and tells them, now we've done the thinking, here's a way that you can spend some money. It's just not a relationship that's built on the best foundation. So we're trying to do that. And so, but if we can have that joint analysis and decide what's most important, then we should all figure out, okay, and 2 or 3 things need to be done Then we can figure out who can do them best. Who's got the, who has the opportunity to do the best work in that case? And I think in most cases we will find, CSO will find somebody else who has the advantage in actually being able to do the work. But where we may be able to be most helpful is in the first 12 months, is when somebody else doesn't, has never done something like this before. So maybe in kind of product development and early initiative is where we should be limiting ourselves to, but again, driving the analysis, driving the strategy, making sure that everybody's included. Those are things that we can bring to it as well. And one way to bring it is by having a little bit of money, though. It's not enough to just be a nice guy.
Well, judging by the hands that went up, this seems like a conversation that could and should go on in other fora and at other times, but we're at our time. Please join me in thanking Assistant Secretary Barton.
Thank you.